So thank you, Ephraim, for the introduction and for the invitation to give a colloquium in Toronto. So I will be talking today about a group which was realized with my guys in Sherbrooke. And in particular, I would like to talk to you about doing quantum optics and quantum information processing with supercomputing circuits. So this will keep us busy for a large fraction of the talk. And then I've decided to give one example of this quantum optics on a chip. And instead of choosing the most recent work, I've decided to choose something where there is a combination of theory and experiment. So the theory was done in Sherbrooke by a former postdoc, Marcus da Silva, and a group I've been working with actually since the time at Yale, the group of Andreas Wallraff at the ETH in Zurich. Okay. So as I said, we're interested in doing quantum optics and quantum information processing with circuits. And so we're interested in working with artificial atoms. If we want to work with artificial atoms, we better have a good reason, because there are some pretty good atoms already out there. These so-called atomic atoms, they're something called. And what is great about these atoms is that, well, they have sharp energy levels, as we all know. And also, because of their potential, these energy levels are not spread uniformly. Okay, so the separation between 0 and 1 and 1 and 2 is not the same. And so in practice, that means that I can shine a laser on this atom, and if I wiggle the electric field of this laser at the 0, 1 transition frequency, well, this laser will couple to the dipole moment of the atom and will induce radiations. And because this energy separation is not equivalent, I mean, it's not a harmonic oscillator, I have no leakage. Basically, I don't get out of this 0, 1 subspace, which is useful for quantum information processing and quantum optics also. Let's put some numbers on how good these atoms are for this task. First, let's take some particular level of the beryllium ion. And imagine we prepare the state 1, like here. Well, it will take its characteristic time T1, which is a few years before the thing decides to spontaneously emit a photon and relax to the ground state. This is pretty long. And then if you prepare a superposition of 0 plus 1, well, the phase in that superposition will stay stable, will stay plus, and that's something else, for a timescale that we call T2 of the order of several seconds. So if you combine this with the fact that it takes only a few microseconds to promote the system from 0 to 1, then that means that the error per gate, the error per manipulation of your atom that you get in such a pulse is pretty small. So if you can bring a system to any state in the so-called Bloch sphere with a sub-percent error, that's pretty good. How does artificial atoms compare? And actually, how can we make artificial atoms? And so our goal is to use a standard toolkits, namely capacitors, inductors, resistors, and wires, and make something like that, sharp energy levels with a distribution which is not uniform. Well, there is a simple way to make, at least, I mean, let's try the simplest thing we can think of. We'll just put an L and a C in a parallel combination. As we know, that's an LC circuit with just an harmonic oscillator. So the energy stored in the inductor, the energy, magnetic energy, in the system goes as phi square, the flux threading the inductance, divided by 2L, the value of the inductance. And so if I plot this phi square as a function of flux, I get this nice parabola, and I can do the quantum mechanics of this electrical circuit, if I care to do it, and what I find is a bunch of sharp energy levels separated by the frequency I should expect, 1 over square root of LC. So is that a good artificial atom? Well, the first thing is there's one good news, at least there. And the good news is that it's quite simple to initialize the system to its quantum mechanical ground state, to put it in the vacuum state. And that's because with current microfabrication techniques, we can have L's and C's such that we're working with several gig frequencies that have several gigahertz. And several gigahertz in temperature corresponds to about half a Kelvin. And half a Kelvin for us is a pretty high temperature because we'll be working at dilution fridge temperatures, which is something like 10 millikelvin. So at that temperature, there's nothing to promote the system from 0 to 1. Okay, so we can really prepare the system of this macroscopic LC circuit, microfabricated on a chip LC circuit, in its quantum mechanical ground state. Okay, so does that make it a good two-level system? Well, the answer is of course not, because I would like to drive this system from 0 to 1, not using a laser, but the equivalent for microwave voltages, for microwave systems, and that's just a fancy microwave oven, a microwave source, which can send pulses of microwaves oscillating again at the 0-1 transition frequency. What do I get if I drive with such a coherent source an harmonic oscillator? Well, what I get is a distribution of these Fock states. What I do is I prepare a so-called coherent state, which has a Poisson distribution of occupation from 0, 1, 2, and etc. And the important thing to see is that I've leaked out of the 0-1 subspace, and as a result, well, it's not a good two-level system. It's really a mini-level system. The solution to that comes with superconductivity. And Brian Josephson, while he was a PhD student in the 60s, told us that for something which is called a Josephson junction, that's the symbol I will use for a Josephson junction, and if you don't know about these systems, well, it's just a sandwich between two superconductors. I have in mind here aluminum, for example, separated by a layer of insulator, aluminum oxide. So aluminum, aluminum oxide, aluminum. You make a sandwich of these three things. And what Josephson told us, well, is this Nobel Prize winning relation, that in a Josephson junction, the relation between the current and the flux is not like in a inductor, which relates current to flux by disproportionately constant, the inductance, but as this strange sine function, current to flux as this strange sine function. So it's relating current to flux in the same way as an inductor, it's tempting to define a Josephson inductance, which is, if I was to calculate that quantity over here, I would just get L. Now for this strange current phase relation, I get this cosine function. And now my inductance has a cosine dependence on the flux. What happens, therefore, if I replace this inductor, which has a purely quadratic dependence, to something which has a cosine dependence? Well, this cosine dependence, I've told you this energy goes as 1 over L. Now 1 over L goes as cosine. And so the energy of this system, where I've replaced the inductor by a Josephson junction, will actually be a cosine if I look in flux space. So this is the cosine that I've drawn in this, transparent tone. And let's focus only on one single well. So what do we see there? Well, we can, again, have sharp energy levels. And actually, the presence of these sharp energy levels in these Josephson junction systems has been demonstrated for 80 years. In 85, already the group of John Clark at Berkeley had shown that these sharp energy levels exist. Okay, but the important thing is now we don't have something which is quadratic. We don't have an harmonic potential. We have something which tails off because of the cosine, and the energy levels need to readjust to that, and now we have something where the energy levels are not uniformly spread. And so that's our artificial atom. The energies are sharp, and the energy difference is different, and it's different enough that you can drive transitions between 0 and 1 without too much leakage, actually without any leakage at all, if you want, if you're careful enough. So let's put some numbers there. How good are these artificial atoms? First, instead of taking a few microseconds to provoke the system from 0 to 1, it takes a few nanoseconds. It's much faster. But of course, we cannot always win, and one place where we're not as good as actual atoms is in the T1 and the T2 time, the energy relaxation and dephasing times. And that's a plot of T2 in blue and T1 in gray as a function of year. And what is actually quite encouraging is that it's better to plot to show this on a log scale. That really shows you that in the last few years, we've done some quite tremendous progress. And actually, in the last months, people have been obtaining now reproducibly T1s just short of 100 microseconds. Okay, this is not a few years, and it's not several seconds for T2. But the important thing is not these bare numbers by themselves, but what you can do with these two numbers. If you want to prepare some in a given state, what is the error that you will do in creating such state? And the result, actually, from experiments is quite similar to what you get with ions, so with actual atoms. And so artificial atoms, I will argue, are pretty good, are pretty good artificial atoms, actually, so they deserve the name. Okay, so what can we do with them? So far I've been talking about shining lasers, bright lasers, or voltage sources, hooking up bright voltage sources to these atoms. let's actually now reduce this electric field to the point where we're dealing with a single photon, or actually the vacuum. And what we would like, that's the field of quantum optics, what we would like is this vacuum, or the single photon, to have a large effect on the dipole moment of the atom. And so the combination of D and E, I'll call G, the magnitude of these two numbers, I'll call G. And it's a two-letter formula. So are we going to have something which has a big effect? Well, we'll choose large D, and we'll try to get large E. And the field which is trying to do that is called cavity QED. And, for example, Serge Haroche in Paris does that beautifully by using Rydberg atoms. Rydberg atoms are atoms where the electrons are far away from the nucleus, and these guys have large dipole moment. And how do you increase the electric field? Well, you confine the field in a tight space by placing the atom in a cavity. And in a cavity, the electric field scales as the square root of the inverse of the volume. Smaller the volume, the larger the electric field is, and even for a single photon, or even smaller for the vacuum, these electric fields can have a large effect on these Rydberg atoms. So the question now is, how can we go from cavity to circuit QED? So first, I don't think it will be difficult to convince you that artificial atoms are large, and so that they should have large dipole moments. So this is an SEM picture of such an artificial atom. Dark green is a substrate. Forget for now these yellowish things. And blue is a qubit. And notice the scale here. If you take a chip where this thing is fabricated on, and you squint enough, you actually see this qubit. Okay, it's big. The action is really going on in this Josephson junction, and we have capacitances which are shunting this junction in the same way. And because we like to manipulate, to choose this capacitance without this capacitance being too wide, we can add little fingers there. And simply because we like things which are nice and symmetric, we'll put two of them. Okay? But that's really the same thing. So that's the artificial atom. As I argue, this is a large object, which will couple, therefore, strongly to any field that it sees. And for example, you can think of these two wires there as something where you can apply an electric field to control the dipole moment of this artificial atom. And the fact that the artificial atom has a large dipole moment is a reason for the gates to be so fast, from a few nanoseconds. Okay. So, what about the electric field? Well, as I said, the trick is to confine the electric field in a small region of space. And this is done with a cavity, basically two mirrors which are facing each other. If you want the cavity to resonate at some frequency, omega, or some wavelength lambda, well, the two mirrors have to be set up, apart by lambda. And then the electric field will be confined in some Gaussian profile along the other directions, which are roughly decaying in a length lambda. And so the volume is lambda cube, and that's how the electric field scales in this 3D realization of cavity QED. How can we do this with a circuit? So what we'll do, actually, is use the 1D equivalent of a coax cable. So everybody knows about coax cables. So you have this center conductor, and around the center conductor, there's some insulator, and then there's a shield, okay? There's a ground plane. Imagine that I take this coax cable and cut it along its length, and I'll show you what I get. So what you'll see are two ground planes, the insulator and the center conductor, okay? Which is what you're seeing here. The two ground planes, air will be the insulator, and that's the center conductor. And now I'm thinking about the blue stuff will be aluminum again on some good dielectric substrate. Okay, but this is not a cavity. We've confined the light in one dimension, but it's not staying in place. This, you can send TV signals with this. And so what we'll do is impose some boundary conditions, the equivalent of the two mirrors, and these are just, in practice, two capacitors, two gaps there. And they define a length or a wavelength or a frequency, if you want, where the system will resonate best. Where if you shine light in the system, everything will be transmitted. Otherwise, away from that frequency, everything will be reflected. And these objects are used as good bandpass filter in telecommunication, for example. Okay, let's think about the mode volume here. So this is roughly lambda long, but all the other directions are a fraction of lambda. And so, in practice, the electric field can be orders of magnitudes larger than in the 3D cavities, reaching in this area between the center conductor and the ground plane, reaching something like, a large fraction of a volt per meter. These are large electric fields. Now what we'll do is we'll put transmon qubit, something I was trying to avoid. These qubits are called transmons. There it is. So we call them transmons. So these artificial atoms, I'll place them exactly where the electric field is the largest, and the electric field of the system will couple strongly to the large dipole moment of this system, and have the large D dot in interaction, and therefore large light matter interaction, like in cavity QED. Why is this interesting? Well, in cavities, you get couplings of the order of several tens of kilohertz. Well, here, it can reach, it's typically a few hundred megahertz, but can reach the so-called ultrasound coupling regime, where G is a large fraction of the resonance frequency of these systems. And so you can really reach in this setup parameter regimes which are not accessible in regular cavity QED. And so it's not just redoing the same physics in a different setup, but now we're opening new parameter regimes where there is new physics to be explored and new questions to be asked. And so in the rest of this presentation, what I will do is that I'll show one such example of a realization of circuit QED. I could have chosen to talk about something more quantum information-ish, but I've decided to focus on the quantum optics aspects. And again, I didn't choose the most latest result, but something where, there will be both experiments and theory discussed. Okay, so we want to do quantum optics with circuit QED. And actually, the question we are after is the following. Can we prepare a single photon of microwave light in the system? Remember, we're always dealing with microwave lights here. So this is roughly a centimeter long, something I should have said before. And so the light you're storing is really at the microwave frequencies. And we would like to characterize this light. So for example, we like this light to preferably exit the system from the right-hand side and then have some kind of detector which goes click when the light impinges on it. And then if we have access to that, when we have access to a whole lot of quantum optics that can be done. And so there's a quite standard quantum optics experiment that you would like to do on the system to, for example, verify, is this really a single photon source? In this case, a single microwave photon source. And at the same time that you'll answer this question, you'll be able to say, is a light in the system really a quantum mechanical object? Or it's really these microwave photons, they're so low energy, they're probably just classical. Is there really quantum mechanics here? And so by looking at the following question, we'll be able to answer these two questions. And so the setup we would like to be interested in is instead of having a single photodetector, we'll have two. But first of all, we'll have a beam splitter. And that's the so-called Unbury-Brown and Twist setup. So photons are now, instead of shiny yellow stars, they're yellow orange circles. And let's look at the next few runs of such an experiment. We're imagining a pulse source where we prepare the same state over and over again, and then we'll read out what these photodetectors tell us. A click will be a 1, and no click will be a 0. And so let's look at a few runs. The first detector click, then the second, again the second. Okay? And delta T is the separation between the pulses, and now we've stored that on our computer in some big Excel sheet. And that's the end of the experiment, and now we'll do some analysis on that and see what quantum mechanics has to tell us. Well, first, there's a simple observation. 1 times 0 equals 0, always. And that's just a statement that if I multiply at the same time the two numbers from N1 and N2, I always get 0, you see? That's because there's a single photon. It only produces a single click, obviously. However, if I compare these numbers at different times, well, there's nothing that prevents the product of these numbers to be 1. And so what I'll plot is the number of coincidences where the product of these numbers are non-zero as a function of the delay. The center will be looking at the same pulse, and as I go up there, it will be comparing pulses which are one pulse with something, another pulse which is further away in time, or a pulse which is in the past. And so what I expect to see is a bunch of peaks, all of these peaks corresponding to the coincidences that I talked about. And the important thing, and this is just delta that you see, this pulse separation, and the important thing is that there's a peak missing in the center. So while this statement, appears obvious when you say it this way, this is actually a signature of the quantum nature of light. The fact that the center peak is smaller in amplitude than the side peaks can only be true for quantum states of light. And in this case, if we see this, well, we know it's a single photon source because 1 times 0 always equals to 0, and we have something which is truly quantum mechanical. So how can we do that in this system? Well, there's quite a big problem. There's nothing... Oh, yeah, actually, before. Because we'll talk about equations at some point, if you want to calculate this count, this so-called the subject is called the G2 correlation function, and if you want to calculate that quantum mechanically, if A represents the state of light, the mode of the state of light that I want to investigate, so A dagger creates a photon in this resonator, well, this is the object that I want to calculate. It's not really important, but if you like formulas, there it is, and it will come back again. And the important thing is that I'm comparing these operators at different times. Okay, but the big problem here is that there's no such thing as a clicking detector in the microwaves. Microwave photons do not deposit enough energy for the detectors to go click. And so what we'll have to do is to use another scheme to measure these correlation functions. And this is where there can be a collaboration between theorists and experimentalists. Okay, but first, before talking about the measurement, let's talk about the source itself. How can we actually prepare these on-demand single microwave photons? And instead of drawing circuits, I'll draw for the rest of the talk this cavity analogy. So I hope it's clear for everyone. These two mirrors is really my 1D transmission line, and that's my artificial atom. And so initially, the atom will be in its quantum mechanical ground state without any photons in the cavity. I've told you that this is easy to do. Just cool down and wait. Now, if I want to prepare a single photon, what I'll do is I'll move away, I'll pull out the qubit from the cavity. How can I do that on a circuit? It doesn't make sense. The things are glued together. Well, now I'm really thinking not in terms of actual space, but rather in terms of frequency. So what I'll do is initially my qubit and cavity at the same frequency, and suddenly I'll change the frequency of the qubit, of the artificial atom. And doing this, when they were on resonance, they were talking to each other quite happily. When they are off resonance, this discussion becomes more difficult because of energy conservation. And for all practical purposes, it's as if I'd removed the cavity from the atom. Sorry, the atom from the cavity. How can I change this transition frequency? Well, in practice, it's quite easy. You can change the transition frequency by about a gigahertz in just a few nanoseconds by applying a short burst of magnetic field on these artificial atoms. This is not an issue at all. So this can be done in a few nanoseconds. Now I'll pulse the qubit and prepare it in its excited state. I've told you that we can do that with very high accuracy. And I'll put the qubit back into the cavity, at which point it would really like, because of this electric dipole coupling, it would really like to give this energy to the cavity as a photon. And it will do that after some time. But once the energy is stored as a photon, the cavity would really like to give it back to the atom. So what I'll do is I'll pull out the qubit before this happens, and I'm left with a single photon. Okay? So tune out of resonance, pulse, tune back in resonance, and wait just for the right amount of time to transfer the excitation. At which point, you have a single photon, which would like it to go click. And it's going always on the right-hand side because I've chosen this to be pretty dark and this to be pretty transparent. Okay. Oh, you can also prepare any states of your qubit, any superposition of your qubit, and this is then transferred to any superposition of 0 plus 1, arbitrary amplitude and arbitrary phase. And this is what we're going to study. So I should say that this has been done before, this type of source, not exactly the same mechanism, but not the same mechanism at all, but the same types of states had been prepared by Andrew Hauck at Yale back in 2007, but they could not show this quantum nature of light that we'll be after in this talk. And I should say that there are some first experimental steps toward actually realizing these microwave clicking detectors, but it's not yet at the stage where they can be used in such studies. Okay, so at this point, I have a rather strange task. What I will have to do is actually explain to you how these microwave measurements are done. I mean, at this point, I'll really, really sound like an experimentalist. But what we'll see is that we'll have to understand quantum mechanically all of these different steps that are going on in these microwave measurements of this light in order to really be able, as we will see, to explain to the experimentalists how they can obtain these G2 correlation functions without anything clicking. And so what we'll have to do is go through the various steps. And so right now you don't have any ideas what this means, but I hope this will become clear. Okay, so the quantum mechanics of microwave measurements. So this is the slide, which is slightly more technical, but after that everything falls through. So I hope, pay attention at this moment. So now we have convinced you, I hope, that we have single photon sources. Actually, I shouldn't have convinced you that we have single photon sources until I've shown you the last results of this center peak missing, remember? So I shouldn't have convinced you, but you should believe me at least that it makes sense to study this system. And so we've prepared some state of light that we now want to characterize. And that state of light, again, will be characterized by the mode operator A. So A dagger creates a photon and A annihilates a photon inside its cavity. And so what we're really after is a light which is leaking out of the cavity. And it's leaking out at some rate kappa. Okay? It's leaking out at a rate kappa. So how can you describe the field which is leaking out? Well, that's pretty easy. That's whatever leaks out, A, with this prefactor, and anything which was reflected here. So you could have a thermal state, or even the vacuum. The vacuum actually plays a quite important role, as we'll see in a second. And so the field that we're actually measuring is this interference between what is leaking out and the reflection of, in practice, the vacuum state. But now I've told you that these microwave photons do not have enough energy for them to produce clicks in detectors. And so if they don't have enough energy, we need to amplify them. We need to put some amplifiers which will amplify the strength of these microwave photons. So how can we think about the quantum mechanics of amplifiers? Well, we're dealing with bosonic operators, okay? And the commutation relation of bosonic operators, well, the commutator with A dagger gives 1, and that should be true for any bosonic operators that I'm dealing with. So then given that statement, does it make sense that the amplified field should just be, well, I take whatever I had before, I amplify it with some gain G, and I get this new operator? Does that make any sense? Of course it doesn't make any sense at all, because it would mean that for anything but unit gain, I violate this commutation relation. And so what that really tells me is that there's a fundamental limit for amplification. And that fundamental limit, preserving these commutation relations, tell me that really I should be adding noise to whatever I amplify. There's a minimum amount of noise that I can add, and that this is this added noise. There's some new modes that I forgot to take into account, internal modes to this amplifier that I should have taken into account before. And quite unfortunately, for these microwave amplifiers, this added noise is something like 20 or 40 photons of noise. And so I have this single photon, okay? And now, on top of it, I've just dumped 40 photons of noise, let's say. And in the end, what I want to see is this missing peak, which was a property of a single photon. That looks hopeless. I mean, how am I going to extract this little quantum thing from this messy, classical object, which is extremely noisy? That's the task that we have. And then the next step is to use something that the experimentalist or the engineers call an IQ mixer, because it outputs two numbers that they like to call I and Q. And what is it really? So for physicists, it's probably better to show this. It's basically a beam splitter. So I'll send this microwave light on a beam splitter, and on one port I won't have a clicking detector, but I'll measure X. X, which is just for, I didn't put any of the correct labels here, but X is going like V dagger plus V, the B, which is at this point. On the other part, I'll measure P. Okay, so I'm measuring simultaneously X and P. Is there a problem with that? And someone should say, well, there's a, you cannot measure simultaneously X and P. Well, I forgot to add here this vacuum port. And the fact that I'm adding vacuum noise means actually that what I'm really measuring is the X quadrature of the combination of this light mode and that light mode. And because of this vacuum port, well, and here I'm measuring the P quadrature of this mode and that mode. And only because of this vacuum mode, actually, these two, this X and this P, commute with each other. That's really because I've added the vacuum. If you forget the vacuum in your quantum mechanical calculation, you get it wrong. Okay, so that's good. I have two numbers which are actually commuting. So I'll be able to play with them as if they were classical numbers. That's pretty convenient. And these two numbers, again, are called I and Q in practice in the lab. Okay, so I have two numbers which I'm measuring, and I'd like to combine them in different ways. So I'll define something which I'll call the complex envelope, although for this talk I really didn't need to say that word. But this is just the combination of what I'm measuring here, X, plus what I'm measuring here, P. So X plus IP. And so I'm really measuring these two classical, I mean, at the output I really have classical numbers. But if I want, I can really think in terms of the operators that were measured that gave me these classical outcomes. And that's S, which is X plus IP. I just take this number plus I, this number. But remember, X and P can be expressed in terms of the bosonic operators in this way. And B, at this point, was what? Well, it was the amplified stuff plus the noise. So the amplified stuff plus the noise, which I've written in this more compact way. But what was B? Well, B what was the field leaking out plus the reflection. So B, so now I've got, if I write B in this way, now I've got the amplified version of A, plus noise. It's a new noise because it has this reflection. And so what I'm really measuring, this guy is A, the field operator. That's it, because this is what was entering in this G2 correlation function, a bunch of field operators. Okay, so in practice, this is done using so-called FPGA electronics. If you're not familiar with that, it's not very important. But the main point is that this can be measured every 10 nanoseconds, and 10 nanoseconds is much smaller than the time, the typical decay time for a photon, which means that you can basically do a movie of the photon leaking out of the cavity if you want. And I'll show you some of these results. Okay, so time is... Okay, so I think I'm fine. Okay, so instead of showing these beam splitters and all of that, instead of showing these beam splitters and all of that, I'll draw this single box which outputs this complex envelope. And I'm showing this little tape cassette. Maybe some people here have never seen that, actually. Joking. This tape cassette actually, meaning that now we'll record all of this information, and then we can do processing on it in the same way that we had this Excel table of zeros and ones, and then we did processing on it. Okay. There's a slight technical detail. It's not really important to talk about it, but the formulas I'll show have this slight technical details in them. And so instead of having a single measurement chain, in practice, it's useful to have two measurement chains. The only reason for that, with a beam splitter before, is it's really technical, actually. It's because when you have these two chains, you can look at these two outcomes and reject all the uncorrelated noise. Anything which is not correlated has to be noise, and so you can throw it away. The signal has to be correlated. It's coming from this single source. So that allows you to just remove a little bit of noise. But again, this is just a technicality. But remember, the formulas I'll show will have SEs and SFs in them. Okay. So, okay. So now it's the time of the talk where I have to decide if I jump forward or if I show this. I think it's fine. Okay. So let's first show some simple examples of what you can do with this technique. So let's forget first about one of these chains and just average out whatever we get here. I think you should be convinced on this point that this gives you A. But now let's do the cross power. Take the complex conjugate of this number, multiply it with that number, and according to the quantum mechanical analysis, this just should correspond to A dagger A. So this should correspond to what you would have gotten if you had a clicking detector and we're looking at the average outcome of this clicking detector. So although we didn't have anything which clicked, we still have access to this average photon number. And so let me show you some results which we're taking in the lab in Zurich. So here's the protocol. First, you cool the system to its quantum mechanical ground state. You pulse the qubit to some interesting state, which I will characterize by on the Bloch sphere by two angles. The Rabi angle, the angle with respect to this z-axis, and the phase angle here. So Rabi angle and phase angle. Then you transfer that to the resonator. You measure what you wanted to measure, and you repeat that sometime like a billion times because there's a lot of noise and you need to average. So these measurements can take 24 hours. And then you average these results. Okay. So let's see if our simple, at this point, quite simple predictions match to the experiment. So S of V should correspond to the expectation value of A. And if I prepare this state, alpha 0 plus beta 1, well, I see that it goes as the sine of the Rabi angle, and it decays at some rate kappa. And so these are the results. So what I'm showing here is the Rabi angle. Did you prepare 0, 0 plus 1? 1, 0 minus 1, or 0, and that's time. So that's a line cut along this axis. Blue is the data, and red is the theory, the simple at this point theory, without any fits. And this is the movie I was telling you about. You really see the photon leaking out of the cavity, and this rise, which is not in this formula, is just because there's a finite bandwidth to the measurement, and this can be understood clearly. Okay. Now, what's quite interesting is that if you look here or there, or if you do a line cut like this, what do you see? Something which goes from positive to negative. What does that tell you? Well, you prepared a 0 plus 1 or a 0 minus 1. So the phase of the wave function has changed. And going through all of this complicated microwave electronics, you were able to pick up the phase of the wave function. You've done some tomography on this phase. Okay, so you can try something else. You can look at the cross power, s of f at time t, and you can take the complex conjugate or the dagger quantum mechanically of this first operator, which should go, as I told you, in this way. And so this is what you get, the same plot. And now you see, of course, a maximum at 1, where this number is maximal. Because this is oscillating, this is because of the way we're pre-producing these states, we're not going from 0 to 1 and then 2, but back to 0. And what's interesting is that now, because this is the square of some photon operators, this decays as a rate kappa and not kappa over 2 as before. And indeed, you can see that this is much, much sharper. Okay, so this is just a simple example to show that this works, and you can do little movies of photons, microwave photons, coming out of the cavity. But is there any really quantum mechanics? Because, I mean, I can write down these quantum mechanical formulas, but at the end, I mean, it's classical signal processing. I mean, for this quantum mechanical formula to make sense, to be useful, I have to calculate something with my quantum mechanical formulas, which is actually seen in the signal processing, which cannot be explained by classical mechanics. And so this is what we're going to do at this point. We're going to look at two-time correlation functions, or this G2 that I mentioned before. We're trying to extract the G2 from these measurements. First, so what we can do is take S at time T and compare it to S at time at a later time. And so this involves something which is called the first-order correlation function, which is just this simple formula. It's the same thing as before. I just added plus tau here, so there's nothing new. Okay? But I show you this because now, I mean, as theorists, our role at this point is to write down these expressions and calculate what they give you. And so now I can calculate this rather complicated expression, and you might wonder why I would like to do that. So I've computed S of E at some different times and S of F at some different times. And what I see is I get a complete mess, but hidden inside this mess, there is G2. So now N, a bunch of G2 of the noise, and a bunch of G1s. That's why I've told you about G1 before. And so now what I'm telling my experimentalist friends in Zurich is that, well, if you want to measure this, you need to measure this. You need to measure this quantity and that quantity, which, by the way, you need to infer from this quantity, and so forth. So I explain to them everything that they should measure, and then they take this, subtract away all of the junk, and they should be left with G2. Okay? And so I'm lucky enough that I have experimentalist friends that actually trust me, and they went about and actually did this in the lab. And here's what they've seen. So this is a pulse experiment. Every pulse will arrive after 512 nanoseconds. And you can calculate, of course, what you should expect for any superposition of 0 plus 1. And what quantum mechanics tells you for G2, that's just simple stuff. Of course, in the theory, we expect that we have a single photon source. So G2 as 0 should be always 0. There's this missing peak. And G2 at different times, what we find, I mean, at this point, very simple theory, is that it should scale as the half of the Rabi angle. This fourth power comes before there's four operators here. And so now they can do this measurement, measure everything, subtract away the junk we told them to subtract away, and this is what they get. So this is G2 as a function of delay for the state 1, and as you expect, there's a missing peak at 0. So this really shows that this microwave light is indeed a quantum mechanical object. Although it's very low in energy, if you deal with it in these very cold temperature environments, you can really do quantum mechanics with it. So you can do a bunch of test experiments. You can prepare the system in the state 0. There's no photons, so you shouldn't see anything. Okay, that's just a test experiment. And you can also do a different test experiment. You will try to fool your system by sending something which really looks like a single photon state, but it's not at all. It's some classical state. So what we'll do is we'll send a coherent state with an amplitude which is really close to one photon, alpha equals 1. And what you find is that, well, in the classical state, as you expect, the center peak is indeed there. Okay, there's some finite probability of having two photons in that state, and that appears as a peak there. So this is really a classical object. And you can do that for a bunch of Rabi angles, and what you find is exactly what you expected for the height of this peak. As a function of the Rabi angle, you expect... The center peak is always 0. The side peaks, they oscillate with this sine function exactly as expected. Okay, so that's photon anti-bunching. That's a technical word for this. My single photons never come in pair. and is a proof that the light in the system is quantum mechanical. And so once you are able to measure these different moments of light, well, you can extend this technique. And this is not something where I was not involved, but the students in Andreas's Walraff group, they extended this technique and went ahead. And if you measure a bunch of these moments, you can actually reconstruct the Wigner function of this propagating microwave light. And here they've prepared the state 1, and the Wigner function has this standard circular shape with the negative bit in the middle. Okay. Well, that's everything I had to tell you today. So I hope I've convinced you that with these IQ transmission line, superconducting transmission line resonators, and these transmon qubits are artificial atoms with long coherence times, I mean, we can produce interesting, interesting physics, but for example, interesting states of light. And it's possible, even if we have extremely noisy electronics, we shouldn't be discouraged to do interesting quantum optics. We can still do interesting quantum optics in this system. And as I told you, for example, anti-bunching. And there's much more to be told about the system. I could have told you about quantum information processing. So simple quantum algorithms have been realized, for example, in the system by simply placing several qubits inside a single resonator. And actually, just last week, the group at Yale has reported the first run of a quantum error correction protocol in the system with a few qubits. And more generally, we're really dealing with quantum mechanics on very large length scales. I mean, we're thinking about objects which are really extended, 1 centimeter for the resonator, where we store these photons, and these artificial atoms, which can be placed, for example, at the two ends of the resonator, can now be entangled over these large distance. And that, by itself, I find quite fascinating. And on that, I'll thank you for your attention.